Tamar and Amnon.
Behold, I will raise up evil against thee out of thine own house. 2 Samuel 12:11.
Amnon sat glumly at the far end of the long banquet table, chewing on a crust of bread and glaring now and then at his father, the king, who held forth with broad gestures and grand words at the head of the table. Even though he was the king's oldest son and heir apparent to the throne of Israel, Amnon was plainly a troubled young man. A scowl was fixed on his dark features, and his brown eyes glowed with a certain strange light as if a fire burned inside him. Everyone in the court of King David saw Amnon's unhappiness. His wives, his generals, his priests, even his servants, all of them, except the king himself. David had many sons, and seldom did he bother to look at any of them. More often than not, he was surrounded by a small crowd of courtiers, all of whom noisily competed for his attention. Even when the king found himself at table with Amnon, which happened rarely, he had much else on his mind. The long war against the Ammonites had finally ended in a victory, to be sure, and David now wore the gold crown that had once crowned the head of the king of Ammon himself. But David could not forget the dire words of that dour old prophet Nathan, who afflicted him with unsettling messages from God even at his moments of greatest glory. "The sword shall never depart from the house of David," Nathan had said, quoting the words of the Almighty as uttered to the prophet in yet another one of his dismal visions. "I will raise up evil against thee out of thine own house." These words of warning were never far from David's thoughts, even as he held forth at the banquet table with yet another wry and slightly ribald tale about the days when he was but a humble shepherd and not yet a king. Distracted by his own tale, bloated with rich food and perhaps a bit drunk, the king surveyed the table without pausing to glance at Amnon. Nor did Amnon watch his father with the keen interest displayed by the others around the table, who listened to the king's familiar story as if hearing it for the first time, and laughed admiringly at his old jokes. What held Amnon's attention was the young woman sitting at the king's right hand, where Amnon felt he ought to be seated. Tamar was the king's daughter, Amnon's half-sister, and she smiled with obvious pleasure whenever the king inclined his head to whisper something into her ear. Now and then the two of them laughed at a secret joke. Something burned in Amnon's heart every time he saw their foreheads touch. The king clearly took pleasure from the company of his daughter, whose sweet disposition and undemanding nature were such a contrast to the grasping and carping of his sons. David had so many sons, and all of them needy and troubled in one way or another, but he had fathered only one daughter. Her name was Tamar. And everyone, even the king himself, remarked on how very beautiful she was. The king did not know it, but the gloomy words of the prophet Nathan were being whispered all over Jerusalem as the latest bit of gossip about the king's sordid affair with the woman named Bathsheba. Amnon had been among the first to hear of the incident, if only because more than one of the courtiers had already begun to cultivate Amnon in the confident belief that he would one day follow King David to the throne. As the rumors had it, King David had first spied Bathsheba from afar as she bathed on the roof of her house. No one blamed him for that. Indeed, one sniggering priest suggested that Bathsheba had fully intended to catch the king's eye, showing herself naked and wet, within plain sight of the palace roof, where David was known to take the night air from time to time. Indeed, it was not unusual for some of the excitable young women of Jerusalem to lie in wait for David in the streets leading up to the palace and to shriek with excitement when the handsome king was spotted on the ramparts above their heads. When it came to Bathsheba, however, it was the king himself who was smitten and lovesick. So he dispatched one of his more discreet attendants to invite Bathsheba into the royal bedchamber, and, like so many other women on so many other warm summer evenings, she did not refuse. Still, apart from David's wives and a few of the fussier priests, No one in the royal palace regarded the fling as much of a sin, even if Bathsheba's husband, a soldier named Uriah, was serving in the king's army in the war against Ammon, while she reclined on the king's bed. But the whispers grew hotter when it was the time of the month for Bathsheba to purify herself at the ritual bath, and she declared herself to be with child. Now the king panicked, and he devised a devilish plan to blame the pregnancy on Uriah. The king summoned Uriah all the way back from the battlefield to the royal palace on the laughable pretense of asking him if the army was well and the war was going well. "Yes, well," replied the puzzled but dutiful soldier. His curiosity satisfied, David urged Uriah to avail himself of his own bed and his own wife, as long as he was in Jerusalem. Uriah, still puzzled, refused the king's suggestion. "My comrades are camped on the battlefield," said Uriah. "How then can I eat and drink in comfort and then sleep with my wife?" So, night after night, the loyal soldier insisted on sleeping at the door of the royal bedchamber, along with the servants, much to the consternation of the king himself. Not even an abundance of the king's wine weakened his resolve. The stalwart soldier drank himself drunk, but did not stray from the king's door. Finally, the king abandoned his goal of seduction and sent Uriah back to the battlefield in service of an even more sinister plan to solve the problem of the pregnant Bathsheba. On the night before Uriah returned to the front, the king inscribed a short letter to Joab, general of his army in Ammon. "Put Uriah into battle where the fighting is fiercest," the king wrote, "and then order your men to fall back so Uriah is alone." The message was unmistakable. Uriah was meant to die alone at the hands of the enemy. David sealed the letter himself, handed it to Uriah with complete confidence that he would not even try to pry it open and read it, and sent the obedient soldier back to the front with his own death sentence in his hand. Later, when Joab sent word to King David that Uriah had been killed in the fighting under the walls of the Ammonite fortress, David painted an expression of sorrow on his handsome features. "Don't fret about Uriah. Sometimes the sword devours one way, sometimes another," the king instructed his messenger to tell the generals back at the front. "Just strengthen your assault on the city and raise it to the ground." The general did as he was told. The Ammonite fortress fell at last, and the rich plunder was soon on its way back to Jerusalem. David crowned himself with a victor's crown, and he took Bathsheba, now well along in her pregnancy, as his latest wife. Except for the gloomy predictions of the prophet Nathan, the future of David and his royal house seemed glorious indeed, just as glorious as God himself had promised. Whenever Amnon pondered the vile way his father had secured Bathsheba as his latest wife, he experienced a palpable disgust that seemed to ball up in his stomach and rise into his throat. Here was yet another wife in the royal harem, yet another son in the noisy brood of royal mouths to feed. The man was an insatiable beast, Amnon told himself, a shameless philanderer who had no place sitting on the throne. When the king finally died, one way or another, and it was his turn to reign, Amnon told himself, the people of Israel would recognize and honor him as a righteous man and an upright king. Such thoughts burned in Amnon's head as he spent long hours at the window of his house allotted to him in the royal compound. Since the king gave him little else to do, Amnon watched the minions who scurried back and forth across the courtyard around which the royal houses were clustered, captains, priests, and scribes in abundance, sometimes the lord of some great estate on his way to the throne room with a petition in his hand, now and then a convoy of concubines headed toward the palace under an escort of armed soldiers, and always a teeming crowd of random servants and servitors. Amnon watched as if in a trance, and imagined the day when they would be serving him instead of his father. From time to time, Amnon's eye fell on one man in particular, who simply could not be overlooked even in a crowd, the commanding figure of Absalom, one of his many half-brothers, the son of one of David's wives, Maacah. Absalom was younger than Amnon, but he seemed to outshine his older brother in so many other ways. Absalom was taller, he was fairer, he was stronger and yet more graceful, he was more genial and thus better liked among the courtiers. To Amnon's consternation, Absalom was regarded by more than one of the busybodies in the court of King David as a more promising candidate to be the next king of Israel than Amnon himself, the rightful heir. To Amnon's relief, he did not encounter Absalom except on formal occasions, and he never found reason to seek out his half-brother. Only when Amnon spotted him in the crowded courtyard was he forced to ponder why Absalom always seemed so good-natured and high-spirited, when he himself, the future king of Israel, was always so angry and despairing. One day, as Amnon stared down from his window, he spotted Absalom and the equally familiar figure of Tamar as they emerged from the palace and headed across the courtyard in the direction of Absalom's house. Like Absalom, Tamar was the daughter of Maacah, and she shared her brother's appealing features and graceful bearing. Amnon had grown up in the same household with the two of them, but Tamar had always clung to Absalom and allowed him to shield her from the playful attention of the other sons of the king. Now Absalom and Amnon had been allotted houses of their own by the king, but Tamar was not yet married and still lived in the palace, so Amnon did not encounter his half-sister except on formal occasions when everyone gathered to listen to the king's tired old tales. Today, however, Amnon found himself staring at Tamar with new interest. He watched from his high window as she walked with long strides across the courtyard, looking up at Absalom and laughing at something he said. Amnon noticed that she was taller than he remembered, her hair longer, her body more womanly. She wore the gown of a royal princess, rich, colorful, and concealing. But the long sleeves and the generous folds of the skirt did not entirely hide from Amnon's eyes a certain voluptuousness in her limbs and hips. Indeed, Amnon did not take his eyes off his half-sister until she disappeared into Absalom's house on the far side of the courtyard. Amnon felt vaguely ill at ease as Tamar disappeared from sight. He swallowed involuntarily, as if something were caught in his throat. Sensation not unlike the one he felt when he recalled his father's exploits with Bathsheba and the baby that grew even now in her womb. But he was aware of something else, too, a certain breathlessness that came upon him when he envisioned the movement of Tamar's long legs as she walked across the courtyard, and imagined what it might be like to stroke her long black hair or touch her smooth skin with his fingertips. A servant interrupted his reverie, but Amnon waved away the food and drink that he was offered. Later in the afternoon, the servant appeared with another meal. Amnon waved him away again, and the dish of food simply gathered flies on the floor of the corridor outside his door. At last, Amnon undressed and slumped into his bed. The next morning, he was up early and spent the day at the window, hoping to catch a glimpse of Tamar in the courtyard below. By the third day of his vigil, the servants were concerned enough at Amnon's inexplicable fast to send for the only man they knew to be his friend, a cousin by the name of Jonadab. "Son of the king," Jonadab said with a mock formality as he bowled his way into Amnon's quarters. "Why do you sit so glumly morning after morning? You are wasting away for want of food. What's wrong with you?" "It's Tamar," said Amnon without turning away from the window. "Tamar?" repeated his cousin. "Your sister? What about her?" Amnon sat in silence for a moment, then stood up and faced his cousin. "Tamar," he said in an insistent voice, "is Absalom's sister." "So, tell me what it is about Tamar," Jonadab persisted, "that makes you act like you are sick with a plague." "I think," said Amnon slowly, "that I am in love with her." Jonadab laughed out loud, and then, when he saw the grave expression on Amnon's face, his laughter turned into a sudden fit of coughing, and he looked away in embarrassment. "Better the plague," he muttered to himself, "than to be lovesick over your own sister." Well, what am I supposed to do about it? Amnon demanded. I can't eat. I can't sleep. All I can do is think about how to get her into my bed. But I can't even get her to talk to me, much less to come into my bedchamber. Jonadab pondered these shocking words for a moment. He was Amnon's closest friend, perhaps his only friend, and Amnon would be king someday. And so Jonadab resolved to act as the friend of a future king ought to act. Get under the covers, he said, and pretend that you are sick. I am sick, said Amnon miserably. We'll send word to your father that you are ailing, Jonadab continued. He will be worried, of course. After all, the illness of the next king of Israel is a matter of the gravest concern. He will come to see you. So what? Said Amnon. It's Tamar I want to see, not my father. When the king comes to you, Jonadab continued, you will ask him to send Tamar to nurse you back to health. Tell him you don't trust the servants to prepare your meals properly. Tell him that's why you are ill and cannot eat. Let my beloved sister Tamar come and make a couple of hearty dumplings for me, you will tell the king. Then I'll eat out of her hand. Amnon stirred when he heard the sound of hushed voices outside the door of his quarters, and he peered out from beneath the covers to see what was astir. He heard one familiar voice, his servant's, and a couple that he did not recognize. One voice belonged to a woman, and his heart raced. He thought that Jonadab's wild plan might have actually succeeded in bringing Tamar to his bedchamber. Then he let his head fall back against the pillow and waited. Quite to Amnon's surprise, the first and crucial step in his cousin's plan had been successful. King David himself, attended by a small crowd of guards and retainers, had appeared briefly the previous day, spent not more than 3 minutes in Amnon's presence, and then bustled out again without saying more than 3 words. The king had seemed unconcerned over his son's ill health, just as Amnon had expected, and seemed to take more interest in the view from the window of Amnon's room than in Amnon himself. But at least the king had listened to Jonadab's somber appraisal of Amnon's ill health, and he had even stayed long enough to hear Amnon recite his lines. Let my sister come and take care of me, Amnon had pleaded, and I will nibble on those luscious heart cakes right out of her hands. After his father left, he had fretted over his choice of words and his unfeigned ardor in speaking them. Perhaps the king would detect what he really wanted from Tamar. Do you think it will work? Amnon had asked anxiously when the house was finally cleared of visitors. Of course it will work, Jonadab had responded cheerfully. And when you have Tamar in your arms, dear cousin, please do not forget who put her there. Now Amnon waited, breathless again, his heart racing as the servant made a noise at the door and peeked inside the dark room. Lord, your sister Tamar is calling on you, said the servant in a whisper. Shall I send her away? Amnon sat upright in bed and fairly shouted, No! Then, fearing that he had sounded rather too healthy, he reclined again and spoke in a hoarse whisper. No. No, do not send her away. I am always happy to see my cherished sister. A moment later, the very thing that had occupied his long hours of reverie for so many days finally came to pass. Tamar stood before him, and his heart gladdened at the expression of concern and even affection that he imagined he saw on her face. Thank you, dearest Tamar, he croaked, for coming to me. Tamar, more curious than caring, cast a long appraising glance at Amnon. Father sent a messenger to summon me, she said. Go to Amnon, the messenger said, and fix him some dumplings. Tamar paused for one long moment, as if to signal to Amnon how strange it seemed to her to be summoned to his house for such an odd favor. Then she continued, The king commanded me to come, and so here I am. Thank you, dear sister, Amnon said, for attending me in my illness. You don't seem very ill, dear brother, said Tamar. She paused again before adding, Thank God? Yes. Thank God I am feeling much better now that you are finally here, said Amnon, watching her with a fixed gaze that unnerved her. Suddenly, I find myself very hungry. Will you make some dumplings for me, as I asked? Yes, brother, Tamar allowed. That's what I came here to do. Now Tamar gestured to a young woman who stood in the corridor with a covered basket, and the servant began unpacking the ingredients for the meal. A jar of flour, a jug of water, a small cruse of oil, some seasonings folded into the corner of a cloth and tied with a string, and an earthenware mold in the shape of a heart. The servant set to work at the big fireplace at the far end of the room, and soon the water was boiling. As Amnon watched in utter silence but with rapt attention, Tamar kneaded the water and flour into dumplings, pressed the thick dough into the mold, dropped them into the boiling water, then fished them out again with a long wooden spoon that the servant handed to her. An aromatic scent of spices and yeasty dough wafted through the darkened room. Finally, Tamar heaped the steaming dumplings onto a platter and handed it to her servant, who crossed the room and stood dutifully at the side of Amnon's bed. "There's what you wanted," called Tamar. "Go ahead and eat." Amnon looked at the platter of dumplings, then back at Tamar, and finally he glared at the others who stood expectantly around the room, a couple of Tamar's servants and his own servant, too, and even one of the youngsters who tended the stove in the kitchen and now sat in the doorway with wide eyes. Everyone was watching him. Everyone, it seemed, wanted to witness the end of the remarkable encounter between Amnon and his sister. "Get out!" he cried out, suddenly finding his old voice and shouting harshly at the servants. "Get everybody away from me!" All of them stirred and scattered. Tamar's servant handed her the plate of dumplings, waited a moment for her nod, and then left the room. His own servant was the last one to leave the room, and he thought to pull the door closed behind him. Only Tamar remained, standing solemnly near the window, and watching her brother in silence from across the room. Amnon shivered uncontrollably as he lay alone in his bed, and he felt suddenly flushed with fever as if he really were ill after all. "Bring the food to me," Amnon called, his voice suddenly thick and hoarse, "so I can eat out of your hand." Tamar approached the bed where Amnon lay, casting a brief glance toward the door, and held out the platter of dumplings. Amnon reached out and seized the wrist of her right hand. The platter fell to the floor, and the dumplings rolled in the dust. She cried out in fright and surprise, but Amnon held her fast and pulled her bodily toward him. "Come on, sister," he growled. "Lie with me." Tamar stared at her brother and leaned away from him with the weight of her body, but he did not let go of her wrist. Her skin began to burn as he twisted her wrist to force her to come closer. She cast one more desperate glance at the door and then cried out. "Brother, don't," she ordered. "I will not lie with you." Amnon grinned crazily at Tamar's words, as if he were encouraged in his attack by the sound of her voice speaking aloud his secret thoughts, and he pulled her toward him with new strength. "A brother and sister together? Such a thing isn't done in Israel," Tamar said. "Don't commit such a sacrilege." Amnon relaxed his grip ever so slightly, then tugged sharply on her arm, and Tamar tumbled headfirst into his bed. He rolled on top of her, pinning her long legs with his own legs and pressing down on her hips with his own hips. Soon only her head was free, and she whipped back and forth like a snake. "What will become of me, brother?" she pleaded. "Where will I take myself after you have shamed me? And what about you, dear brother? You will make yourself an outcast in Israel, and you will have nowhere to hide from your deed." Amnon considered these words for one grave moment, and Tamar sensed an opportunity to persuade her mad brother to break off his assault. "Perhaps there is a way, Amnon," she whispered urgently but intimately into his ear, her voice now assured and commanding. "Speak to the king. Ask him for my hand in marriage. The king won't keep me from you, I promise." But Tamar's words seemed to provoke Amnon rather than reassure him, and he jerked his head away at the very sound of her words. "The king won't keep me from you." Abruptly, Amnon renewed his assault on Tamar. He tore away her maiden's garbs and pawed at her body with both hands, using his own body as a weapon to overpower her. Amnon had his way with his sister in a series of brutal thrusts that betrayed more anger than passion. A few moments later, it was over. Amnon released his sister from his grip, then rolled away and seemed to sleep. Tamar, bruised and bleeding, lay next to him as she pondered what she ought to do now. She surprised herself by not weeping, and she pondered the faint sensation of some warm fluid turning cold on her bare thighs. Was it blood, she thought to herself, or something else? Amnon awoke a few minutes later and looked at the ravaged young woman who lay beside him, mostly naked, and marked here and there with ugly bruises that were even now turning black and blue. Suddenly a wave of revulsion, not unlike nausea, welled up out of his belly and choked him. Whatever it was he had felt toward Tamar a few moments before, love or lust or some other unspeakable passion, now turned instantly and massively into its opposite. The very sight of Tamar sickened him, and so he planted a bare foot on her naked hip and kicked her out of the bed with one powerful thrust. Tamar tumbled to the floor, where she lay among the dumplings she had offered him a few moments earlier. "Get up," he said, fighting back the inexplicable rage that tasted like bile in the back of his throat. "Go away." Tamar struggled to her feet and stood unsteadily in front of him. The bodice of her gown was torn on both sides, exposing her breasts and her battered hips, and blood oozed from her nose and the corner of her mouth and between her legs. "Don't send me out like this, brother," she said in a low voice that barely concealed her own dangerous rage. "To send me into the street like this is even worse than..." Tamar fell suddenly silent, and Amnon started shouting for his servant. "Get this thing away from me," he bellowed. "Put her out and bolt the door behind her." The servant of the future king of Israel obeyed his master, and Tamar found herself sprawled in the courtyard outside the door of Amnon's house. She struggled once again to her feet, and she stood with the bearing that befitted the daughter of the king. She covered herself as best she could in the torn and tattered gown. But she did not set off in the direction of the palace. Instead, she headed toward Absalom's house, weeping bitterly as she made her way through the curious crowd. Absalom was summoned by the house servants to the entry where his sister had collapsed. He tried to soothe her in his own clumsy way as he led her to a bedchamber where she might find some privacy and some rest. "Hush, sister. Could have been worse. At least it was your brother and not a stranger," he said by way of consolation. "Don't take it to heart." But his words only seemed to provoke her, and he decided to leave her alone with her grief for a while. When he returned, to his amazement, he saw that Tamar had heaped ashes on her head and rent her garment like one in mourning. Tamar put on the black garb of bereavement and never took it off again, and she spent the rest of her days in desolation under the roof of her brother's house. When David heard of the outrage that had been committed against his daughter by his eldest son, he thundered and cursed and generally made a proper show of kingly temper to all who were in attendance at that terrible moment. But he did nothing more than that. Absalom waited in vain for the day when the mighty king of Israel would chasten the man who had raped the king's daughter. But the day never came. And soon it appeared that David had forgotten the whole unpleasant incident. Absalom said nothing more of the matter to the king or anyone else, including the desolate Tamar, except for the fact that he refused to speak a single word to Amnon, good or ill. It appeared that Absalom, too, had forgotten what had happened to Tamar. Then, fully 2 years later, Absalom arranged for a banquet to celebrate the sheep shearing in Baal Hazor. He invited King David and all his sons, including Amnon, to attend the festivities. Every one of the princes accepted Absalom's invitation, even the unsuspecting Amnon, who regarded the banquet as a pitiable effort by Absalom to ingratiate himself with the future king after his long and insulting silence. Only King David declined to make the journey to Baal-Hazor and join his sons at the banquet table. A great disappointment it was to Absalom that his father was not there. Absalom would have preferred David to see with his own eyes how Absalom gave the command to his men-at-arms, "Strike down Amnon." He would have preferred David to see how Amnon, silly with wine, struggled so comically to protect himself against the sword blows. He would have preferred David to see his firstborn son bleeding to death like a slaughtered calf. Then, Absalom thought to himself, David would have realized how a man should behave who is worthy to sit on the throne of Israel.
Much of the book of Samuel is the work of an anonymous biblical author who seems to possess an intimate knowledge of the official history and the dirty little secrets of King David and his royal family. The court historian, as he is sometimes called, is not merely an archivist and chronicler in service of an ancient potentate. Instead of the customary assortment of kings' lists and battle lists, the inventories of enemies ruined and spoils taken, and the glorification of the reigning monarchs by their scribes, all the standard stuff of the servile propaganda that passed for official history in distant antiquity, the court historian writes boldly of the flaws and the weaknesses of the monarch, the challenges to royal authority, the scandals of the royal court, and the least glorious moments in the lives of the monarch and his many wives and children. "It is real history," wrote Sigmund Freud, 500 years before Herodotus, the father of history. The story of Tamar illustrates the destiny of a nation. Amnon's private crime against his sister sets into motion a chain reaction of very public crimes that shake the throne of King David and, in a real sense, continue to resonate down through history. At the height of his power and glory, David conquers the city of Jerusalem and establishes his capital on the future site of the temple, subdues the enemies of Israel on all sides, and extends the reach of his empire to the farthest boundaries once promised to Abraham by God himself, from the river of Egypt unto the Euphrates, Genesis 15, verse 18. The reign of David is the high water mark of sovereignty and the long history of Israel. Never before David did the Israelites enjoy such blessings, and never again will they enjoy them after his passing. David has come to be regarded as an exalted figure in both Jewish and Christian tradition, the prototype of the monarch who reigns by the grace of God. And yet the adoration of David in the Bible is counterbalanced by a frank and sometimes harsh account of his misdeeds. David's dalliance with Bathsheba and his conspiracy to murder her husband are described in an open-eyed account that confronts us with the king's appalling crime. Even David's role in the rape of Tamar is recounted without the spin we might expect from a court historian. The king is shown to be an accomplice, perhaps an unwitting one, but perhaps not. And he does nothing to punish the rapist or vindicate the victim after the crime has been exposed. In fact, the biblical author artfully echoes David's affair with Bathsheba in his account of Amnon's rape of Tamar. Both stories begin with a lustful glance, escalate into a forbidden sexual encounter, and reach a climax of bloody murder that can be ignored but not erased from the pages of Holy Writ. The Bible was fixed in its current form at some unknowable point in distant antiquity, but the tradition of explaining and elaborating upon the Bible, which went on even when the Bible was still being written, has never stopped for a moment. Midrash is the Hebrew word that describes the ancient and honorable tradition of telling stories in order to reveal the inner meaning of sacred texts. One author whose life work can be understood as a contemporary Midrash is Isaac Bashevis Singer, the master storyteller whose stories and books were honored with a Nobel Prize in 1978. Singer wrote, "God is a writer, and we are both the heroes and the readers." Singer, whose novels were often serialized in the Yiddish-language Jewish Daily Forward before publication in English, encourages us to regard all life as the daily episodes in a serial that began with Genesis. One keeps on reading it day and night, Singer concluded. The fear of death is nothing but the fear of having to close God's book. What both Singer and the biblical authors understood is that ordinary men and women are not plaster saints. Real lives include moments of passion and pain, sin and scandal, just like the ones we find in the forbidden and forgotten texts of the Bible. Indeed, the landscape that is described in the Bible is so alluring, and the Bible itself is so enriching and enduring, precisely because it is peopled with men and women who are capable of both joy and sorrow, good works as well as great evil, acts of compassion and acts of cruelty. The path across the biblical landscape is not straight and narrow, nor does it always lead to a city on a hill where all is goodness and light. Rather, as we have now seen, the Bible road wanders through some dangerous and yet tantalizing places where both skeletons and treasures are buried. Hidden away among those Psalms and Proverbs, the begats and the thou shalt nots, are groves of enchantment and killing fields. But these places are not easily found, and few guides will point the way to them. And sometimes, as we are traveling toward some shimmering spiritual truth that beckons us on the far horizon, we should be careful not to overlook the intriguing and instructive sights that can be seen at the side of the road.